I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Scott Wilper. He's executive director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy. Leslie Allison, who is executive director of the Western Landowners Alliance, and joining us by phone, Frank Sims, chairman of the board for the Chamapeake Land Alliance. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
And we are delighted, especially today, because Leslie Allison is the recipient of the 2014 Pachesky Conservation Award. There's an event this coming Saturday from 3 to 8 at the Pachesky Conservation Center here in Santa Fe, and we'll be talking about that. But first, let's just talk for a moment, Scott, about what New Mexico Land Conservancy is all about.
Sure. Good morning, Mary, Charlotte. The New Mexico Land Conservancy is a statewide nonprofit land trust. We're based here in Santa Fe. And we work all around the state of New Mexico with private landowners, government agencies, and a variety of like-minded partners to protect special pieces of private land that have wildlife habitat values, productive ag land, scenic open space, cultural resources. We have a pretty broad mission. We've been
and
around.
Protecting land means making sure that it doesn't get developed?
Yes, yeah. The primary tool that we use to conserve land is called a conservation easement. It's a legal agreement between private landowners and a land trust to basically restrict subdivision and development and certain other uses on the property in order to protect some of those different conservation values that I mentioned. And the nice thing about the whole movement, it's private, it's voluntary. The landowners actually retain ownership of the land, but we are essentially gaining an interest through these easement agreements, and by agreeing to hold these easements, we're taking on a permanent responsibility to monitor the easements and make sure that they're in compliance over the life of the easements.
And people continue living there.
That's right. They continue to live on the property, and they're able to engage in a wide variety of compatible uses. For example, about 80% of the easements that we've done have been on working farms and ranches. So they're giving up the development rights, but they can continue to farm and ranch, harvest timber on a managed basis, engage in recreational activities. They still, generally have the full use of their property.
So let's talk for a moment about the Western Landowners Alliance. This is a group that is from the southern to the northern borders of the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
What do you do?
Okay, so we're a network of landowners committed both to conservation and to sustainable working lands. So we have landowners all over the country who are working to improve land health. They're restoring streams. They're voluntarily recovering native species. They're pursuing sustainable livelihoods, managing their forests well. And this is an organization that helps connect those landowners across the West to give them a collective voice, to share knowledge on things, to share science, and to help advance this movement really across the West for a healthier landscape.
One of the things I think that is tricky, and I'm wondering if both you and Frank can talk about this, is that there is kind of like a way that always things have always been done, and then new ways of doing things. And a lot of times rural people, ranching people, farmers tend to be pretty conservative and traditional. And then changing those ways, how do you do that?
Well, I think that's a big piece of why we formed, because landowners are much more diverse than I think people really understand. Across the West, there are a number of different types of land ownership and interest out there. Including the ranching and farming traditionally. But ownership in the West has always been very much a mixed bag. And if you look back as early as the days of, Teddy Roosevelt, you'll see that landowners have always cared very deeply about their landscapes. What ends up in the news, like what happened recently in Nevada, is what the public comes to understand about Western land management.
What happened recently in Nevada?
Well, that was a conflict between a public lands rancher and the BLM over the use of that landscape and the protection of endangered species on that particular landscape. But it also came with a whole history of his particular occupation of that landscape without paying his grazing fees. And really, when you look across the West, it's a minority involved with public lands grazing. Actually, it's a very, very small minority. It's about 2% of the population, actually, in the West is involved with public lands grazing. But of that 2%, many of those are very good stewards of the land. They're trying innovation. They always have. Because if you're going to stay on the land for any period of time, you have to find a way to make that a sustainable use. So it's really not quite what the public thinks. So we want to give a voice to those people who are doing a good job at stewardship. That said, there are constant innovations going on. Technology is evolving. Science is evolving. Knowledge is evolving. And people try to keep up with those things. So it's not just like you have somebody who's been doing it one way and then suddenly black and white. It's a whole new way. It's much more nuanced than that.
Very interesting. Frank Sims, I was wondering if you could talk about your experience. You're with the Chamapeak Land Alliance, and you're also the president of Running Elk Corporation. Tell us about those organizations and about what you're doing.
Well, Running Elk Corporation is a federal corporation that's owned wholly by the Hickory Apache Nation, who is a cooperator in the Chamapeak Land Alliance. So Chamapeak Land Alliance is a collaboration, perhaps coalition, of like-minded landowners who are deeply committed to the landscape at large that, in many respects, we control in the north-central San Juans of northern New Mexico, south-central San Juans of Colorado, and this landscape, incredibly rich wildlife, timber, water, delivers critical ecosystem services downstream Albuquerque, southern New Mexico, Santa Fe, etc. So it's incumbent on us as like-minded landowners to recognize the value of the landscape at large, the critical components of the land that provide downstream water, work on habitat enhancement projects, watershed improvements, wildlife migration corridors, critical components that must not be overlooked and must not be neglected. So in conjunction with the Hickory and participating landowners, in the Chamapeak Land Alliance, we are operating on about 1.3 million acres of critical land that is absolutely essential for the delivery of critical ecosystem services to New Mexico and southern Colorado. We also recognize critical importance of our rural heritage, the rural landscape, which all New Mexicans and people from Colorado have grown to love and respect. We want to retain our cultural identities, recognize the importance of our rural economies and regional economies, and how they impact the greater economies of two states, notably New Mexico and Colorado. So it is it's fascinating to watch the landowner community come to realize and appreciate that we are stronger standing together and can do more of productive value and benefit for the land and the net users of the environmental services that we provide, typically downstream, but not only downstream, but to our own communities as well.
We're talking to Scott Wilbur of the New Mexico Land Conservancy, Leslie Allison of the Western Landowners Alliance, and Frank Sims of the Chamapeak Land Alliance. Leslie, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about ecosystem services. This is a concept that is, I think, still new to some people.
Right, right. So I think people are increasingly recognizing that there is a very real environmental value to some of the sort of the outcomes of the ecosystem. So, for instance, our watersheds, our forested watersheds, help produce water for us. They retain the snowpack, they absorb it, they filter it, and they deliver clean water that supports us, and that's sort of the easiest example. But our trees sequester carbon. These lands produce wildlife habitat, which supports our hunting economies. There's just a multitude of things like that that these landscapes provide for us that we in society come to depend on. And increasingly, people are trying to figure out a way to put a monetary value on that because they're recognizing that there's a certain amount of stewardship investment that has to go into these landscapes if we expect to continue to benefit from these ecosystem services. And that's what's led to the development of what's called ecosystem services markets.
There are so many interesting examples of that, like honeybees, which are very threatened right now.
Right.
For a lot of different reasons. Right. Honeybees, without honeybees, you got nothing.
Right. That's exactly right. And that's a great example of that. And so if you don't have landscapes capable of producing the things honeybees need to survive, it impacts everybody.
So some of the projects you've done, I actually watched a video on your website about the restoration of the Odell Creek headwaters, which is a beautiful project. And one of the things that's really interesting, and I was wondering, again, whether any or all of you could talk about this, is when you do a restoration project on a relatively small piece of land, what the impact is beyond that land.
Sure, and that's Jeff Laszlo's project up there in Ennis, Montana. He's restoring a 6,000-acre wetlands complex on a working cattle ranch. The wetlands had been drained in the 1950s to create more grazing land, and he's now restored that wetland and has kept track. He's monitored since he began the project of the number of species that have been recovered on the property, and it's astonishing. There are birds that haven't been seen there in decades.
And you wondered, like, where were they? Like, where did they come from, and how did they find their way back?
Yeah, it really is quite amazing. And in some cases, they haven't been seen in the entire state in decades.
Yeah.
And suddenly they appear on his property and are flourishing, and the streams are healthier, and the water is better, and a water retention. And actually, that brings us back to a project in New Mexico that sort of highlights this, which is the San Juan Chama Watershed Partnership that the Chama Peak Land Alliance has initiated. It's got about 100 different stakeholders to show you how a small area can impact a big population. The watershed in the San Juan Chama largely is on private land. There's probably, really at the end of the day, probably less than 70,000 acres directly contributing to that water source, maybe 100,000 acres up there. But that water supplies more than 30% of New Mexico's drinking water supply. It supplies 50% of Santa Fe County, up to 90% of Bernalillo County. A majority of Albuquerque's drinking water supply comes out of that very small drainage, which is heavily forested right now at tremendous risk for wildfire, and it's already diseased. And so landowners up there are trying to work to find ways to thin those forests and restore the health, which will both improve the water security as well as water quantity coming down to New Mexico.
We all have maybe an altruistic streak, but what is in it for landowners in an example like that to make sure that Albuquerqueans are getting fresh drinking water?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that, actually, because the project did not actually begin by trying to get Albuquerque drinking water. The project began with landowners up there who've been managing these properties for decades. Frank's been very involved with that, who've been watching forest health decline and have had their hands tied in terms of being able to treat that, because the timber industry has faded away. There are no mills. There are very few loggers left in the region, or even trucks to haul materials. And so without markets, and with prescribed fire being a very challenging treatment for private landowners, there have been very few options for those landowners to restore those forests to health. So it was a concern about forest health, because all of the landowners in that region are managing for ecological health and long-term viability.
And maybe I could chime in here for a minute too, Mary Charlotte, and just talk about the importance of incentives for a lot of the work that we do with private land conservation. You know, in our case, with the land trusts, you know, we're very fortunate to have both a system of federal tax deductions that support private land conservation. And here in New Mexico, we actually have a state tax credit now that's been in place for a number of years. so that landowners who donate land or easements for conservation purposes can actually get a significant tax benefit from doing this, which in the case of the tax credit here in New Mexico is actually it's a transferable credit, so they can either use it to offset their tax liabilities, or they can actually convert these credits into cash. So it's another way that we can, you know, bring some resources to the table to incentivize some of this work, because, you know, a lot of the people that we're working with are I would describe as kind of being land rich, cash poor, you know, and so just having a deduction, you know, at the federal level by itself isn't necessarily enough to motivate some of these people to work with us. So we're constantly, you know, working to try to enhance those kinds of incentives. You know, one of the other things that I feel that we need very strongly here in New Mexico is some kind of dedicated state funding to support land conservation and restoration, because New Mexico is really not getting its fair of the federal pie, and that's largely due to the fact that we just don't have the matching resources to leverage those federal grants. You know, there's a number of programs that we work with that support conservation easement acquisitions and support the work that Leslie's group does as well, that have come down through, like, the Farm Bill programs, like the Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program, this new Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, EQIP, you know, which provides a lot of cost-sharing resources for landowners that not only need to, you know, install basic improvements on their properties, but also are interested in doing things like habitat restoration. So.
We're talking to Scott Wilbur from the New Mexico Land Conservancy, Leslie Allison from the Western Landowners Alliance, and Frank Sims from Chama Peak Land Alliance. And Frank Sims, who's joining us by phone, you are really working a lot with large multi-use areas. Talk about that. Like, what are the different uses and how do they work with each other, things that maybe we Santa Fe urbanites might not think of or be aware of?
Well, Mary Charlotte, the landscape up here is the case throughout New Mexico and Colorado is uniquely intertwined, irrespective of ownership, whether it's state, federal, or private. So the connections are there, but frequently society has mandated, through restrictive laws and covenants, different management strategies and practices. So trying to coordinate is of critical importance, the entire landscape at large. And that's why what Scott is doing, Leslie, so many other entities and organizations are doing is so absolutely pivotal in this day and time. And we are all aware that we're living in incredibly perilous times with the specter of climate change, global warming, persistent and prolonged drought, diminished water capacity and delivery. So, you know, linking entities together who share a collaborative approach, like-minded people, whether it's public, private, doesn't matter. But it is of critical importance that in today's day and time, we really assume a very proactive approach to managing natural resources. And we live in a day and time where global population is in excess of 7 billion people today. And by 2050, it's estimated to be in excess of 9-plus billion. So wise and sustainable use, and Leslie spoke about sustainability a little bit ago, it is incredibly important. It runs the gamut to how our societies work, how our economies work. We have become habituated to a economy based on fossil fuels, which I understand the business model, but the business model's not working for the environment. So we know we need to change. We need to do it in artful ways that cause people to want to go forward and cooperate and participate for all of the right reasons. The game that we have been playing from the dawn of humanity has caught up with us, and we really must become better stewards of land. So that really is the goal of the day, is to cause people to become very active, very concerned, and not to withdraw or despair, but become very proactive in their commitment to make things better. And it's a very dynamic opportunity for us all.
We're talking to Scott Wilbur, Leslie Allison, and Frank Sims about land use, land protection, and land conservation.
Leslie, what are some of the interesting projects and innovations that you're seeing throughout the West? I mean, I think it's fascinating that this Western Landowners Alliance is so vast.
Well, yes, and we're new. We're still growing, but we have a West-wide reach because there are landowners, in fact, all over the West doing all kinds of innovations. So some of the best stream restoration projects going on anywhere are happening on private lands. We see a lot of landowners managing for cutthroat trout restoration, the Rio Grande cutthroat, the Colorado River cutthroat, and so forth. You see a lot of wetlands restoration taking place. You see innovations in forest management, for instance, prescribed fire, juniper removal, restoration of sage-grouse habitats, all of those types of things. Even with energy development, we've seen landowners trying very hard to make sure that energy development that is happening around or on their lands is happening with the most state-of-the-art practices, the highest level of environmental responsibility.
What kind of energy development are you talking about?
Whether it's oil and gas, wind, solar, really trying to pioneer the best practices out there and hoping that by pioneering these things on private lands that we can help public land agencies adopt some of these more innovative practices. There are wonderful rotational grazing programs going on out there, holistic resource management practices. Lots of experimentation can happen on private land that cannot as easily happen on public. Aspen regeneration is one of the projects you see more on private land than on public because we have more latitude.
Let's talk about that. What is the importance of regenerating aspen groves?
Well, so aspen has been in decline in western states for the last couple of decades, and people aren't certain exactly why. There's clearly some links to climate change. There's links to fire suppression. There are some disease issues. Drought is impacting them quite a lot. But aspen is an incredibly important species in our ecosystems. It provides forage, shelter. It's called the asbestos forest sometimes because it resists fire. It helps us create a mosaic across our landscape so that when fire does burn, it burns in a more patchy pattern rather than just taking out everything. So the lack of aspen regeneration has been a concern. Part of it is also because of heavy elk pressure as our elk populations have increased. But aspen requires a disturbance to regenerate in many cases. And it would be a disturbance that mimics fire, for instance. So the best way we can do that in the absence of fire is usually small patch cuts. There are small, tiny clear cuts. And then what we found is you have to fence those, often with a brush fence or a wire fence, to keep elk and deer out of that unit until the aspen get big enough that they can withstand that kind of pressure. So we see a lot of that happening.
How have you faced, or to what extent have you faced, for example, the hot-button issues of top predators like wolves, which have been very controversial on both public and private lands?
Yeah, wolves are one of those species for sure. In fact, probably the most controversial of all the species. So we occupy, at Western Landowners, and I think Chamapeake Land Alliance very much so as well, something that one of our board members, Bill McDonald, coined the Radical Center. The Quivira Coalition has used that term a lot. It means the space inside of these polarized debates where there's about 80% that everybody actually does agree on. And that's the voice that we'd like to have heard more often. But there are those areas where there's the 20% of controversy. And in Western Landowners Alliance, we want to address those too, because those are the things that sometimes come back to bite you if you haven't addressed them. And so on an issue like wolves, we have a very diverse membership and we have diverse views on that, but we bring the dialogue together in a way of having mutual respect, openness to that. And we don't look at black and white answers. So if you were to say, should wolves exist or not exist? We think that's kind of a silly question. Wolves do exist. Do they belong everywhere on the landscape? No, they probably don't belong downtown in Santa Fe. Do they belong in some places in the landscape? Absolutely, there's a role for it. Wolves, they're a keystone predator. They're important to the ecosystem. They evolved with this ecosystem. So there are places, and there are places in between where it's going to be very challenging for folks, whether it's because they've got livestock or because they're near suburbs, rural sprawl. Those are areas where the management of wolves becomes very challenging. They also conflict, of course, with some of our game populations in some places, and sportsmen have concerns about that. So is there sufficient prey? Is our landscape ecologically healthy enough to support it? Is there enough room for them? Those are all the real questions you have to talk about, and that's what we do talk about, no matter whether it's wolves or any other subject.
What is your hope for the West as a place where people can make a living and where the land can truly be sustained? Because, I mean, if we look with clear eyes at the last, 150 years of how land has been used in the West, it was sort of that attitude of the land as a vast resource that will never stop giving, as opposed to the current view, I think, which more and more people hold, which is that it's a vulnerable and limited living system.
Absolutely, and I think Frank pointed out we're at an incredibly critical time in our history right now, and more than ever we need to understand how we can derive our living from the landscape in a sustainable manner. We can't turn it all into wilderness. We need the land to survive, and so not using the land is not an option for us. We need to learn how to use it sustainably. And that's really why we're so focused on innovation in land management practices and in working with landowners who are trying those innovative things out, providing support both through policy, through financial mechanisms. Because that is our challenge today, is to figure out how to make that sustainable. We think that that's possible. We're looking at Western landowners, at the big drivers that are shaping the Western landscape. And those start with everything from federal economic policies, subsidies for certain kinds of agriculture that make it hard for other kinds of agriculture. That shapes whether people can make a profitable livelihood in the West in a sustainable manner. Energy development is really changing the picture for folks. We need to look hard at energy development. And even wildlife management policies, there are ways that we can incentivize stewardship on these landscapes that are profitable for the landowners who are out there trying to make it work and beneficial as well for the species. So we're looking at all those types of big drivers.
I think one of the reasons it's hard to sometimes get our minds around these issues is what we see represented in the media is really different from what you're talking about here.
Yes, I think that's really true, and it's a central part of the message that we're trying to get out there. And the debate has for so long been largely defined or framed by industry trade groups and environmental organizations about how we use our public lands. But actually, there's a gigantic center of the country out there that doesn't fit.
Now, industry trade groups, we're talking about like...
So, for instance, cattle growers associations, timber associations, oil and gas industry, all those are trade associations that have been representing landowners and land use interests in the West. And on the other side, of course, are the environmental organizations. But in between are private landowners, and they're an extremely diverse group and are not well represented, actually, by either of those most of the time. So if you look at the population, for instance, in the Intermountain West, there's about 12.5 million people in the Intermountain West. About 80% of those actually live in urban areas. And of the remaining residents that live in the rural areas, only about 10% are actually engaged in ranching, in public lands ranching. And many people do run cattle, have agricultural operations, are very tied to the West, but also care very, very deeply about the wildlife, the water, the future of the West. And that's the voice that isn't being heard. So a landowner presumably loves the land. That's why they own the parcel. And they want to pass the parcel down to their kids in good condition, with wildlife, with resources. We all, I think, want to follow that old saying, which is that we do not inherit the land from our parents. We borrow it from our grandchildren. And this is something that landowners take very, very seriously across the West, regardless of whether they're engaged in agriculture or not.
But at the same time, you've got people who are doing these giant hog farming operations who call themselves landowners.
Right. And that's, you know, the industrial ag, the big ag, as it's sometimes called, has really dominated a lot of our public policy on agriculture, continues to dominate that. And that's one of the drivers that we're looking at, because we believe that sustainable family farms and ranches are the path to the future of the West. Rural livelihoods, environmental values, and all those things benefit from those types of operations when they're done well. The industrial, the subsidies given to industrial operations is something that I think as a nation we need to be looking a lot more carefully at. One of the problems in the way that the debate has been framed is that I think it creates in our own minds a picture of ourselves that isn't accurate, that we're either ranchers who don't care about the resource or we're environmentalists who hate ranchers, and that is simply not the West. The West loves right. its ranchers and its wildlife and its water and its forests.
I think sometimes the clashes that you have are not as much clashes of ideas as clashes of culture, and it's like rural and urban culture to some extent.
Exactly, and a lot of times it's just simply how those cultures have been profiled in the media. But if you go into almost any rural neighborhood in the West and you start talking to people, you will be surprised by what you find. You'll find that there are maybe fewer quote-unquote old-timers. Lots of people move to the West. It's always been a transient place. So you have a lot of new folks. You have folks that move west and buy land maybe for the first time in a county but have been involved in agriculture elsewhere in their lives. Or you have folks new to agriculture but diligently studying and learning everything they can about how to implement it. You have people who are not managing for agriculture. In fact, most Western landowners are not managing for agriculture. Most are trying to manage for wildlife, recreation, or other values out there. And again, that's a voice that simply has not been represented. So, you know, an important message is that the West is not as polarized as the media and some of these groups would lead us to believe. And if we could create policies that support landowners in managing for multiple objectives, we'd get a lot further down the line.
I think another thing that keeps that sense of polarization in place is the Democrat-Republican split.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. So both in the Chamapeak Land Alliance and in Western Landowners Alliance, I'm sure it's true for New Mexico Land Conservancy, easement holders as well, is we're completely bipartisan or nonpartisan. We have folks from all sides of the spectrum, from every age group. And the truth is, when you sit down around the kitchen table at the ranch, conservation is not a partisan issue. It's something that everybody understands the need for. It's like conserving your own spending. I mean, conservative, the definition of conservative and conservation go together. So we're conserving our resources for future generation and continued prosperity. So it's not a partisan issue.
It becomes a partisan issue when you look at, for example, the current governor of New Mexico, if I may say so.
Well, it seems to be because of the way the debate has been framed, and that is something that different groups have used to get votes or raise money. But the truth is, and I've spoken with the governor directly, she cares very much about the resources. She does care very much, particularly about New Mexico's water supply. And so the trick is to stop creating this polarized rhetoric, this political posturing that's about vote getting, and really come together in this radical center space where we're trying to leave the world in a better place than we found it. And I don't know a person that doesn't really want to do that. And so we like to say conservation is common sense. It's not a conspiracy theory. There isn't anybody that doesn't want clean water, healthy landscapes, wildlife, sustainable rural livelihoods. Those are things we all agree on. So we have to stop making it a partisan issue.
How did you come to this work yourself?
That's a good question. Well, I grew up here in New Mexico. I grew up on an inholding in the National Forest, private land inholding, very small, but spent most of my childhood outdoors, and then went to Columbia University and came back to New Mexico.
Wow, Columbia University.
Yeah, it was a big change. I wanted to see what a city was like.
Yeah.
Came back out west, worked at St. John's for a while, and then some friends of mine actually acquired a ranch, and I ended up managing that ranch for 16 years up in southern Colorado. And it was as a ranch manager that I began meeting neighbors who were managing like we were for land health. The guy that I went to work with when I took the job said to me, "Your job is to create ecological health on this place make sure that we try to leave this piece of the world in better condition than we found it for our kids and our grandkids, and to learn everything you can about the land so that we can pass the knowledge down through generations as to how we can be sustainable on it. That was my job.
That was my job description.
And my first task was to fish out all the non-native trout from the stream so we could restore native trout
Good
to the
heavens.
System. I know. It was a rough job, but someone had to take
how
it.
How did you do it?
It was hard. I had to fish very hard every afternoon. We ended up doing a lot with forest restoration, stream restoration, all kinds of different science out there. And it was a real joy. And I thought for a long time that I worked for one of the more unusual people in the world. You know, we'd heard of Ted Turner and some others out there, but I thought this was a pretty unique situation until I met my neighbors. And as I met one neighbor after another, whether they were working cattle ranchers or recreational property owners, I discovered that they were all doing that. They were managing for cutthroat trout restoration, forest health, all those sorts of things without financial incentives in most cases. Really trying to do the right thing. I knew a rancher who had very, very little cash, as Scott said, often land rich, cash poor, never had had any cash, had offers of many, many millions of dollars to purchase her ranch, and she was getting to retirement age. And she said, there is no way I would ever sell this ranch for development. She put it under conservation easement. She's doing a river restoration project on it right now. And it became clear to me that that's really the norm, not the exception. Throughout that entire landscape in the Chalmapeak Land Alliance, that's the norm. And as I got involved with Western landowners, it was also the norm in all the landowners we meet across the West. The question is, can we create the policies and the financial opportunities to enable them to leave the world a better place?
What are some of the policies that you think are necessary?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, you could start with water is a real issue. The use it or lose it water rights, the problems with not being able to leave water in stream for fish and wildlife is a great example. If you do that in some cases, you lose your water rights. So that's a clear one. Trying to restore fire to the landscape on private lands is nearly impossible between the insurance liability issues, the costs associated, and then the jurisdictional conflicts that happen. So, you know, you have to somehow stop that fire right at the boundary. Or if it's on the public side, you can't let it across because the lawyers will tell you it's too scary. Fire is one of the most important tools out there on the landscape. The species restoration is a great example. So if you've been a great caretaker of your land and you have what we call high ecological site value, your land's in great condition, and of course the species are present. Your neighbors have plowed it up, ruined the land. Well, when a listing comes, who's going to bear the brunt of all the regulations? It's going to be the landowner that took care of that place. Often in county land use codes, the places where the wildlife remains are on these private lands. They're refugia for our wildlife. And so counties want to try to protect that land from development. So who takes the brunt in terms of regulation? It's the landowner that did the most to care for that land. So we'd like to change that. And
that's very interesting. Nobody knows that.
No, nobody knows that. And you know, like New Mexico right now has got the issue of public access to private streams. And I know that's a very controversial issue. But if you look at it strictly from the conservation standpoint, if you have a landowner that's invested an enormous amount of time and money into making a great riparian zone, and there are fish in the stream, there's healthy riparian vegetation there, and downstream, where there's been public access and frankly very little funding to pay for the maintenance of our stream systems, and that place is littered, there are no fish left, and now you open the access, well, where do you think the public wants to go first? Right to the area that's been most restored. And if that is a critical cutthroat trout habitat, for instance, you're going to destroy it. You're going to destroy the spawning beds. If it's harboring willow flycatchers, one of our endangered species, if it's the place where deer and elk come to get a drink or to have their fawns or their calves, now the public descends on that without any guideline, without any restriction, and destroys the very thing that we most need to protect in New Mexico, which is our stream system. So it's just, if you look at it through the conservation lens, there are a lot of policies that are impacting private landowners' ability to take care of these landscapes. Split estate is a great example. You can put a conservation easement on your property. You can restore your rivers. You can do all kinds of things out there. But the dominant estate is the mineral estate. And unless there's a clear balance between developing energy and the surface values, those surface values get injured.
So there was a film called Split Estate, and I think a lot of people have become aware of this, which is that basically if you own your land, somebody can still come and drill on it.
Yes, yes. And that's
if you don't own the mineral rights under your land.
That's true.
And, I mean, one of the things that, as far as I can tell, would be most helpful with that in terms of the conservation picture is moving subsidies from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources and doing more R&D in those to the point where the price of those is competitive with or lower than the price of fossil fuels, in which case it's sort of game over.
Right, absolutely. And it's that same kind of subsidy in our food systems that subsidizes non-sustainable food production at the expense of sustainable food production. So we do need to change that. And that's where we want to bring the landowner voice. These are landowners that care deeply about conservation. They're willing to stand up for endangered species. They're willing to stand up for clean water. And that voice has not been at the table. And now they're bringing that to the table. And it's not just through Western Landowners Alliance, through the Chamapeak Land Alliance, but you have organizations like the Malpai Borderland Group, and you have the Blackfoot Challenge and the California Rangelands Coalition and the Quivira Coalition and the Diablo Land Trust. There are many, many organizations springing up around the country that are bringing this voice to the table. And it just couldn't be in a more important time to do so.
Leslie Allison, does the Western Landowners Alliance get involved actively with trying to change policy? Are you out there lobbying state and federal legislators?
We are involved with trying to change policy. We are a nonprofit organization, so our capacity for direct lobbying is limited. But what we do is we try to help educate policymakers, agency leaders, landowners, and nonprofit organizations about these kinds of issues and help try to bring that landowner experience to the table, because sometimes things that look good on paper really don't work well out on the ground, and our landowners can inform those policymakers in that way.
I think it's really important. I mean, we were talking before we went on the air about how if you're in Washington, it's really hard to understand the West. I mean, it's important to get, and even people from one part of the state don't understand another part of the state. Are you able to get people to actually travel and see the land in person?
Well, you know, we actually just helped organize a meeting between Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell and some ranchers up in Oregon who are part of the Country Natural Beef, supplies some of our Whole Foods, and folks to talk about sage-grouse conservation that's happening up in that landscape. We have brought landowners to Washington to talk directly to folks there. We work with delegate staff out in the West. So, yeah, we do try to make those connections, and we try to do as many tours as we can out on these parcels, and we'll be doing more and more as we grow.
One thing that I can't help but think about is, I mean, when we talk about all these plans and the vision that you have for sustainable family farms and ranches in the West happening inside of a larger ecosystem that it's, you know, connected with and cognizant of, instead of this sort of model, this sort of corporate model of let's just exploit the land and doesn't matter where we are kind of thing. How do you get from one to the other? Because, I mean, there is so much corporate land and that is the dominant model right now. I mean, does it have to just fall apart and collapse on its own?
Well, you know, our focus is really on private land in the West. And there's a lot of public land in the West, so that's not corporate land. There are private timberlands, but even the timber companies are actually trying to do some pretty neat sustainable work on their lands as well. So in the West, we're focusing on private deeded and then leased public allotment acreage. And there's many, 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 many millions of acres out there under that type of ownership. And so that's really where we're focused. And there's connectivity through that. There's lots of room for wildlife to move across those landscapes. Those lands provide important connections between public lands, for instance. So wildlife can move off of public lands across these private lands onto other public lands.
Scott Wilbur, it's just about time to go, but anything you want to let us know before we take off?
Well, I would like to let your listeners know about the event that we're holding out at our facility, the Pachesky Conservation Center, this Saturday, October 4th. It's our annual celebration of land conservation, which we call Corazón de la Tierra. And as part of that, we're going to be presenting our annual Pachesky Conservation Award to Leslie Allison for all the good work that she's been doing in the last few years with both the Chamapeake Land Alliance and the Western Landowners Alliance. And the event is going to be held from 3 till 8 p.m. We're located out on Richards Avenue on the way out to the community college, and there still are some tickets available for sale. Anybody who's interested can call into our office at 505-986-3801.
Scott, did I read that there's going to be a whiskey tasting at this event?
Yes, there will be some whiskey tasting, and we definitely hope people will stick around after the formal awards presentation to sample some of the Taos Lightning. And also, people should bring their dancing boots, because we're going to have some great country western music provided by the Rifters, which is a well-known band here in New Mexico out of the Taos area.
Excellent. Well, you guys always throw a great party. Scott Wilbur is Executive Director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy. Leslie Allison is the winner of this year's Pachesky Conservation Award, and she is Director of the Western Landowners Alliance. Frank Sims is with the Chamapeake Land Alliance, as well as the Running Elk Corporation. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You.
And if may I just say one more thing, too. The Western Landowners Alliance, as part of these weekend's events for landowners, will be hosting a policy engagement training Saturday morning at 9 a.m. at the Hotel St. Francis downtown in Santa Fe. And then again on Sunday, we'll be having the first annual New Mexico Landowners meeting at the St. Francis beginning at 9 a.m.
Now, if people are not yet members but they'd like to join, can they show up at these events?
They sure can, and they can also look at our website. We're at www.westernlandownersalliance.org.
And New Mexico Land Conservancy is at nmlandconservancy.org, and the Chamapeake Land Alliance is at chamapeake.org. There's a lot for people to write down. I'll put it all on my website, santafe.radiocafe.org. Again, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.